Mackin Park sits right next to an elementary school in North Kansas City. It's got two baseball diamonds, some bike paths, you know, park stuff.
Most of all, because I don't.
It was pretty quiet when we arrived on a recent weekday, but a girl and her grandmother were setting off on a bicycle built for two.
Okay, off we go.
Yay!
City officials have been trying to draw more people to this park at lunchtime by creating a little rendezvous of food trucks in the parking lot.
Amazing. These tacos are amazing. Mm-hmm. It's the lighter flour tortilla. Has a little bit of cabbage. We even have pork or beef, but the sauce is just so fresh.
KCUR has been visiting Northland neighborhoods to meet with people and hear about the issues that matter to them. We learned that of the 10 community centers in Kansas City, only two are located north of the river. People felt a strong sense of connection to their neighborhoods, but craved more opportunities for interaction. Opportunities such as soccer fields, outdoor movie screenings, and food truck stations in public parks. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today's Central Standard is all about public gathering places in the metro. As you might have guessed, we're starting up north and working our way south. We've got Zachary Clevenger in the studio now. He's the Ward 3 councilman for North Kansas City. Hi, Zach.
Hi, good morning.
It was just 2 weeks ago that the Northland News announced the city's plans to create a food truck hub in Mackin Park. That announcement turned out to be the most popular news item the Northland News has ever posted on its website. I mean, ever. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think a lot of people are going to the Northland, and especially North Kansas City. I think we've got a great little city. We have many different amenities. We are a small town feel, and we're close enough to the KC metro area that it's a very focal point in the metro area for North Kansas City.
A focal point, but one that it sounds like needs a gathering space.
It does. We have a few gathering spaces. We have at Mackin Park, we have a lot of programs for seniors. The Parks Board has a lot of programs for seniors and young children. It's got great amenities, as you spoke of, with a bike track, a walking trail, playgrounds, shelters for rental. We've also got the YMCA, North Kansas City YMCA, which is the YMCA partnered with us this year and brought in a lot of new members. So I think it's really a great little community. We've got excellent police and fire and a great park system.
Why does the city want to be involved in something like food trucks? How did this idea come up?
Well, the idea came about, we were approached, I think our community development department was approached by some food truck owners that wanted to come in and have like a central congregation spot where they can park their trucks and draw people in to their businesses. So they approached the community development department, and the community development department approached our Parks and Recreation Board to see if they could obtain a permit for allowing some food trucks to park at Mackin Park. That way they're not interrupting traffic flow or anything like that. So that's how it started off. The Parks Board gave an initial okay for the initial trial period. We've got a trial period from August 1st to August 31st to see how it goes.
What are you kind of observing there? I mean, are you observing whether it's something that adds this kind of community feel for the city, or are you observing it from more of a business standpoint?
Well, I'd like to, I view it kind of in a middle of the road way. You know, we certainly want to be progressive. We want to grow our city. You know, added lunch options for, we've got a lot of industry. North Kansas City has about 4,500 residents that live there, but during the day we have about 20 to 25,000 residents or people that come into the city to work in the city, and giving them different options. We've got big companies such as Cerner, North Kansas City Hospital, and so I think in some ways it's been fairly popular there. It's a little bit premature to kind of give you figures or how it's going because it's only been a couple of weeks that the food trucks have been there.
The idea hasn't gone over swimmingly with everyone, in particular the owner of a place called The Little Store and Cafe. What is The Little Store and Cafe?
Well, The Little Store and Cafe is one of the hidden gems in our gym hub of city, North Kansas City. They provide lunch, and they do have some breakfast as well, and they close at 6 p.m., so if you want an early dinner. Have a wide range of items, food items. They have usually a daily special. Their lasagna is fantastic, and their breakfast is really good. A lot of people go down there on Saturday mornings and congregate and have breakfast and talk shop. So it's a historical landmark in my district and in North Kansas City. It's been there since the 50s, not under the same ownership all the time, but it's always been a landmark and a place where people can go. Another great thing about the little store is that they do offer deliveries. They do deliver food, and that helps a lot of our residents, especially in my ward. We have several senior citizens, and if they can't get out, the little store will deliver food to them at their front door.
This sounds just like, I mean, in addition to being a restaurant, kind of an old corner store kind of model.
Correct.
Well, the owner came to a city council meeting after that article about the food truck came out, and he said he thought it was unfair that the city was fostering this community of food trucks because he thought that the people coming out of the park, hanging out, would just have all these options right there and would no longer be coming to his place. The idea of unfairness is an interesting one. Do you think that the city is fostering community and making its own park more vibrant, opening up new opportunities for new business people, or is it favoring one business model over another?
Well, that's something that we don't want to do, is favor one business model over another. I don't know that the city is really involved in this. We were approached by the Community Development Department to see if this was an option that the City Council would like to consider. And, you know, certainly we want our city to grow, but we do want to protect the businesses that are established in North Kansas City and have been there, you know, in our city. So, you know, I don't really know if the city is fostering it. I really don't know how to answer that question. We want to grow our city, but we also don't want to hurt our existing business owners. So it's a very fine line. And, you know, if we've got some time, I think I've got a compromise that can make everybody happy.
What's that?
Well, the compromise is, and we haven't discussed it as a council yet. Now, I do want to make sure that these comments that I'm making here, these are my opinions. They do not reflect the opinion of the City Council as a whole or the City of North Kansas City.
Right. Zach Clevenger speaking now is Zach Clevenger.
Zach Clevenger, that's right. My option, on Friday afternoons in the park, we have, our Parks Board has many great programs. And Friday in the park, they have what's called Friday in the Park. They have a concert usually that starts around, I hope I've got my times right, around 11:30, and it goes till about 1 o'clock. A lot of people congregate there because we have like a concert, like a jazz band, or we have country music from Byron Jones and the Northtown Opry. You know, we've got several different groups that come in and play music. So I'm thinking right now the food trucks are there Monday through Friday. And I can understand the little store's fear because North Kansas City High School has an open campus for lunch. So the kids can leave and go get their lunch and come back. Or they're supposed to come back. So we think they do. But I would say, why don't we allow the food trucks to come in on the Friday and service the Friday in the park? That's going to, there's already going to be people at the park. A lot of people at the park, and I think that would be good business for them. But then it allows the little store and other businesses, such as Quick Trip, which is down the road where the students go, it allows them to have their time as well without much competition. It's just such a fine line to walk, and so I think that's just an option that I have, is maybe having it on Friday in the park. A lot of times in the evenings during the summer, they have movies in the park in the evening. The little store closes at 6. The movie starts at 8. Bring on the food trucks. You know, let them service the movie in the park as well. So I think we could come to a compromise, maybe 1 or 2 days a week, allowing the food trucks there, and then it allows the little store to be to do what they do.
Well, you know, I did mention this idea of the corner store, like the little store and cafe being kind of in that old corner store model, and that we're looking at maybe two business models. But two also models of how people find community. I mean, that corner store was the place where you know, everyone would stop by for their coffee, their tube of toothpaste, and to share pictures of the grandkids. And then you've got this row of food trucks where people can bump into each other in line and talk about whether they've tried the Korean tacos yet. That's a really new school kind of model. Do you think that we're just maybe seeing kind of some growing pains as generations change and ideas about how you do this change?
Well, I don't think the little store is you know, against the food trucks. I think their only concern is, would it take away from the business, from their business, from the students that come and get their lunch? It's something that I know they're a little bit different models, and I think, you know, we need, that's why we did the trial period, is to see how this goes. And the kids came back to school yesterday, so, you know, we're going to be looking at it very carefully. You know, I will admit that the little store is a historical site in North Kansas City, and we want to, you know, keep that history, but we also want to grow our city as well. But I think that... And I had another thought, and it just flew out of my head.
Happens to me all the time. We're hearing something from folks in North Kansas City that we're actually hearing from people all over the metro, that they want more places to mingle casually with neighbors, have shared experiences. Speaking of the movie nights, a guy started outdoor movie screenings himself in his yard to fill that void, and they got so popular that they moved elsewhere. And it raises the question for me about whose job it is to make these things happen. Is it the city's job, or should citizens be creating gathering spaces by doing fun things?
Well, we as a city, we want to bring more people into the city, and we'd love to have people gather and talk and get together and, like you said, show pictures of the grandkids and everything like that. So I think it's the city and the Parks Board does a great job of getting programs and bringing people into the city, and it's not even people in North Kansas City that'll come, but other people that'll come as well. You know, going back to the little store, I think, you know, they're on a pretty tight line between profit and in the red, in the black and in the red. So, you know, it's very delicate for them as well. But to answer your question, I think that the city and the Parks Board work very good, very well together in fostering community spaces, you know, expanding on the North Kansas City Community Center, which is now being managed by the YMCA. You know, a lot of people congregate there as well. We just are in the process of, we're renting a building right now and in the process of possibly purchasing the building at 1041 Burlington, which is the new Parks and Recreations building. And they've got, you want to talk about a gathering space, go down there and check that out, because, you know, they've got card games, they've got movies down there at the Parks building, they've got potluck dinners, and so, I mean, they can have 30 to 40 to 50 people at any given time at the Parks Board, at the Parks and Recreations building. So I think that's a really good gathering space there.
Zachary Clevenger, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
And now it's time for... Why don't you talk? It's Tell KCUR. This week, we've been asking our listeners about their favorite hangouts and gathering places, homes away from home. And here to talk to us about what we heard is Allison Rollitz, KCUR's social media editor. Hi, Allison.
Good morning, Gina.
I've got my trusty notebook ready so that I can visit all of the places we heard about. What did people tell us? Is there a typical kind of place Kansas Citians like to hang out?
Well, I actually heard probably about a little bit more than a handful of different types of places. And just to kind of hit the nail on the head, we asked people specifically, where are you most comfortable when you're not at home? So we could have asked people, just where do you like to hang out? But we wanted to really capture that just utmost comfort and home-like feeling. So naturally, you know, we even asked a lot about this in the question that we asked, the outdoors was a big theme. People mentioned trails, dirt roads, and parks. So that was, you know, pretty expected.
Dirt roads?
Yes, yes, on an unpaved dirt road. I used to have one behind my house. It was lovely. So, you know, libraries. People like the peace and quiet of just being around the books. But then we also had a bunch of booze hounds kind of write us or tweet us And they really mentioned several bars in town, or just kind of restaurants. Maybe it wasn't just Booze Hounds, but, you know, the Rock and Run Microbrewery, Harry's Country Club in the River Market, Frank's North Star in Lawrence, and YJ's in the Crossroads. So those were just some of the actual kind of more privately owned public places that you can go to. And then people felt really at home with entertainment and sports. Movie theaters were popular on this list, as Sporting Kansas City even popped up. And then I really kind of love this note we got from Facebook from Mark Ronfeld. He was explaining how just the idea of shopping makes him feel at home. Mark says, wandering through an antique or vintage shop, thinking about the stories the items could tell, and amazed at the creativity of artists when those old things are repurposed.
Wow.
So just that activity makes him feel like he's at home.
That's very creative.
Yes.
Did we get any other unexpected answers to this question?
Well, someone named an entire city that makes him feel at home. Richard Renner wrote us an email saying that just sitting on Mass Street in Lawrence, Kansas, or Massachusetts in Lawrence, Kansas, just people watching when school gets back in, that makes him feel like home. So I don't know if he has a lot of visitors at home or, you know, why that makes him feel so like home. And then the idea of clubs and the people making people feel like home instead of a physical place was kind of interesting. We had a gentleman, Terry Smimo, wrote us an email about this rocket launch club he does kind of out in rural Kansas, out in this big field, because they launch rockets. There can't be any trees. There can't be anything.
Sounds fun, though.
It is, yes. And so he said the idea of being in that big treeless place just provides such an idea of serenity and peace to him that he really loves. And I'm going to read a little section of his email. Terry says, it doesn't hurt that the place has beautiful sunsets nearly every evening. And it also doesn't hurt that my favorite people in the world are usually there as well. So again, this notion of kind of shared interest with friendship, just like the people you're with can be a sense of home.
That is an interesting idea, though, the idea that the activity draws people to a space and not necessarily infrastructure or something. So maybe we all just need more hobbies.
Yes, or more friends.
More friends would probably help. What's your favorite home away from home, Allison?
I thought about this all week as we were doing this. And I'd have to say the ocean is my home away from home. I, as many of our listeners, are landlocked, and so I don't get there very often. But when I do get to the ocean, it is kind of like the sky's field. There's such a sense of peace and serenity when I look at it. And I was just there last week, and it'll probably be another year or two before I see it again. What about you, Gina?
Well, I have a handful of coffee shops I really like to go to, but sure. I would say that I had an interesting conversation that this brings to mind with a woman who was a security guard at a museum where I worked. And I was in my 20s and living in a tiny apartment with no outdoor space and kind of whining about that on a beautiful spring day. And she was like, well, why don't you just go out in that giant garden you've got? And I was like, I don't have a giant garden. I just said that. What are you talking about? And her response was, Luce Park, that rose garden, that's yours. That's your lawn. And she kind of reminded me that all of those spaces, you know, that those are ours, you know. And every time I go mm-hmm. to parks and go to, public spaces like that now, I think I sort of pat myself on the back for how great my lawn's looking these
days.
There
you go.
Well, so Allison Rollitz, social media editor for KCUR, thank you so much for playing, as always.
Thank you, Gina.
You can still help us map the great gathering places in the metro by calling 816-235-2888. Tell us where you go to be part of a community, to run into people you know and catch up on the gossip or news. Is it a physical place or do you gather online? 816-235-2888. When Central Standard returns, how a bunch of hammocks transformed a quiet corner of the Crossroads. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back. It's Central Standard on your favorite gathering place on the radio, talking about KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I've got a couple of guests with me now to talk about the importance of public gathering places and how they come about. Do we make them or do they just happen? Daniel Serta is our go-to urban design guy, and he's here to help us unravel that. Thanks for being here, Daniel.
Good morning, Gina.
Why do you think it is, that everywhere KCUR has gone to host these community listening sessions, people tell us they want more of these kinds of places where there's a critical mass of people casually sharing a public place. Is this a particular challenge in Kansas City?
I think it has been. We're a very auto-centric city. And the reality is we spend a lot, probably way too much of our day, sitting inside a little metal box with wheels on it. And I think there's also a generational shift going on. There are a lot of folks that have grown up in suburban communities where there's a relative lack of gathering spaces, especially informal gathering spaces, places to sort of linger on the street and just have informal contacts with people on a regular basis. And there's a shift in expectations, and people are looking for more of those kinds of places. I think it's a challenge, but I think it also opens up a lot of great opportunities.
Do urban and suburban Kansas City share this challenge equally, or does it look different in different kinds of communities?
I would say the magnitude of the challenge is similar, but the challenge is a little bit different. In suburban locations, it's a relative lack of these kinds of places. In urban locations, there's no lack of the places. There's more a lack of a sense of comfort and security and certainty about whether that's a good environment. And that's, you know, been the challenge traditionally. But what's really interesting about that is you're seeing this very interesting interplay and juxtaposition that's been happening over the last 10 or 15 years, I think, led by initiatives like First Fridays and the Crossroads, where people are rediscovering the city and rediscovering, you know, this kind of activity, this sort of lingering on the street and bumping into people you sort of know, don't know, and then see them, you know, every so often. It's really what makes the city interesting and dynamic.
What's your short answer to the question of whether we make gathering places or if they make themselves organically?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, you need some of the physical characteristics of, you know, businesses locating there, the availability of space, wide enough sidewalks where you can walk comfortably and that sort of thing. But you'd be mistaken to assume that it happens entirely spontaneously. There is a funny dynamic at work. It's sort of like Yogi Berra's old aphorism that, you know, nobody goes there anymore because it's so crowded. You know, what is it that leads to a place really becoming very lively and bubbling and that sort of thing? Well, there's informal activities and there's people going there, but there's usually underlying that a lot of initiative and a lot of work. I was mentioning to someone the other day, First Fridays did not happen by accident. It is a very lively, very organic kind of feeling sort of thing. But I remember 10 or 15 years ago, it was at a different scale. It requires a lot of work on the part of the galleries and the venues that open their doors in advance. And it wasn't something that was just, you know, magically brought from the sky one day. It was an idea that a number of people had and started planning and started to organize and started to take on. And it does, these kinds of things do take on a little bit of a life of their own. And people assume that they're just magically happening in the background, but there's usually a certain degree of initiative among people.
What can we learn from the example of First Fridays and the Crossroads?
I think there's a couple of things. The first is what I just said, which is that, you know, it takes planning, it takes initiative, it takes some energy. I think the second thing is it takes a good environment. You need to have an environment that's really conducive to bringing people together, to making an interesting experience, to get people to see, you know, it's worth walking around that corner because there's probably something just as interesting over there as the place that you've become really familiar with.
If it requires a deliberate effort to make gathering spaces, whose responsibility is that? I feel like in Kansas City, part of the deal that can be that places exist, but a lot of them are just empty. And that's that Yogi Berra thing you were talking about. Like, mm-hmm. I don't go there because nobody's there. Sure. But like that park across from Crown Center, it's really cute. There are nice walkways, cute lampposts. Parks like that should be teeming with people walking dogs and meeting friends for lunch. But I have to admit that I have never personally strolled there or sat there with a sandwich, even though I have had that thought several times, like this park should be full of people.
Sure. Well, let's just imagine Gina decided every day to start having her lunch there. And everybody knows you're a great sociable person. And people know, you know, Gina, I've seen Gina over there on Tuesdays and Thursdays almost every week. And, you know, people start gathering. I'm being a little bit flip about it. But the honest answer is that, it takes at least a basis of a couple of people to pull something together like that. I think the corollary to that that's really interesting is it only takes a couple of people to start pulling something together like that on a regular basis. There are challenges with a space like Washington Square Park in that it's a little bit isolated. It's hard to get to because of traffic. A lot of the people generators, so to speak, the hotels, the office buildings and such, are not right on that block. They're actually across the street, across streets that carry a lot of very fast-moving traffic. And so that isolation creates some real obstacles. But I think concerted efforts to bring a place like that together can be successful, again, provided that people have a sense that there's a reason for being there. It might be as simple as the food trucks you were just talking about.
Let's hear from someone who used one simple object to turn a quiet city lot into a really buzzing space where people did love to hang out while it lasted. Jarrett Mellenbruch is an artist. And Jarrett, remind us of your project from a few years back. You called it Float.
Yes, that was titled Float. It was an installation of a dozen hammocks as part of the Avenue of the Arts. It was behind the Performing Arts Center on the main lawn in front of the Grand Ballroom.
And so the Kaufman Center for the Performing Arts over
yes.
at around 16th and Broadway.
Yes. Yeah, so it was a large, gorgeous, underutilized lawn with dramatic architecture surrounding it. And I was looking for a catalyst or a way to give people permission, essentially to engage with that space.
The word permission is quite a word choice. Do you think that people need permission?
Sometimes in the public realm, I think there's a question as to whether or not it's public space for you and I who are walking down the sidewalk, whether it's public space that maybe is part of a corporately owned building. A lot of the street architecture that's out there right now is sort of designed for us to sit somewhat uncomfortably on it, definitely not fall asleep on it, kind of keep moving, be basically indestructible. And there's a sort of unwritten tone that's often set in the public realm, which is that you're kind of meant to just pass through on your way to someplace else. And so permission in this sense, I thought, would invite people in to do more than that.
Did the location, this lot next to the Performing Arts Center, did that spot inspire the project, inspire you to put hammocks there? Or did you have the idea of using hammocks to transform a space and then go looking for where you might do that?
That's a great question. When we apply for the Avenue of the Arts grant, you kind of apply with an idea. It gets reviewed and approved. And during the period of time when I had applied and gotten accepted, there was a lot of construction going on over there, and the Avenue of the Arts was actually delayed for a couple of years, and there were some funding issues. And when it came back online, the area had been transformed. The Kaufman Performing Arts Center was finished. This huge lawn was there, and I reacted to that space. I reassessed my idea, and I let the space inform the project. I had no idea that I wanted to use hammocks for anything. It just was
the
a
space
matter of,
demanded them.
Yeah, it was a matter of just trying to go to a space and listen.
So you put 12 hammocks there, and what happened? Socially, what happened?
More than I could have hoped or imagined. While I was installing the hammocks on the first day, by the time I had two of them in and was sort of situating the third one and assembling the parts, the first two were full. And there was a convention going on. They were AP test graders, and they were on their lunch break.
A wild bunch, I hear.
Yeah, they were crazy. they were on their lunch break, and they saw this guy down on this lawn setting up hammocks, and it didn't take them long to come down and start filling them up. So I literally had people waiting to get in them as I assembled them. And after that, it just became sort of a snowball effect where they came out to use them every day on their lunch break. There were grown men and women in suits running down a green lawn to try to secure one before the lunch break crew came out in force and filled them up.
It was very recess-like.
Yes, that's a perfect word for it. It was like adult recess.
What happened when it turned into a real phenomenon. People were really using that space, hanging out there all the time. Like you said, the hammocks were full, but the activity spread beyond just the hammocks. What happened when the installation was over and it was time for you to pack them up? I mean, did people keep hanging out, or has the space basically emptied out again?
That's a great question, Gina. And to be honest, I didn't continue to monitor it after my project was down. I'd be very curious to know about that, but I have a sense that it probably returned to how it was, because when the hammocks are gone, you're sort of back to a gorgeous green lawn, but no way to really engage with it comfortably. There's nothing drawing you in. So I have a feeling that right now it's being used as it was before the hammocks went in.
Daniel Serta, does this example illustrate anything for you?
Oh, absolutely. I think the operative phrase in what you're just talking about is that idea of permission. And, you know, if you think about the idea of permission, we have certain rules and conventions that start getting programmed into us. I think the other word that's important here is that idea of adult recess or play. You know, I think about my kids. They don't ask permission to start jumping up and down on the bed. Right? As adults, we tell them that's not something you do. There are visual cues all over the built environment that tell us what you are and you aren't allowed to do. A lot of them are so subtle we don't consciously think about them.
What are some examples?
Well, you know, it's sort of, just think about a sidewalk. I mean, why is a sidewalk there? It's there, you know, obviously in a very utilitarian sense, just so that you can walk in front of a business. But the idea that you should hang out on a corner of a sidewalk, there's a certain, you know, social and cultural lens through which we evaluate whether that's appropriate or inappropriate. You know, if you live in an area where that doesn't happen and suddenly you see a few people, particularly late at night, hanging out on the corner, you know, you might call an authority figure and say, you know, this is very strange. This is very unusual. And that's one of the things that I think is so great about these kinds of little interventions, where you disrupt that norm. You literally sort of start jumping up and down on the bed. You put something in a space that there was probably no lack of energy and thought put into the formal design of that space. And even maybe a concept that, you know, we need green spaces in cities, and green spaces will in and of themselves attract people. But again, all of a sudden you have this little gesture that connotes permission to do something that's a little bit unconventional. And it's amazing how people can follow that cue, and you end up with a pattern of activity and an opportunity that people really appreciate and that you wouldn't have expected otherwise.
Jarrett, social media was kind of a part of how people shared the experiences they were having on the hammocks you set up in the crossroads. Do you think that that made a difference? I mean, in today's world, is it possible to have a gathering space that doesn't overlap with the online space?
It's probably possible, but in this case, I don't think, especially given the fact that it was a temporary installation that was only up for one summer, that it would have reached near the level of popularity and use that it did without people sharing photos of themselves on the hammocks using social media. So it wasn't something that I had initially intended, you know, to be part of the project, but it was certainly what happened when it was just let, you know, evolve organically.
Do you think that there's a lesson in what you did and how it went for, I don't know, for other people, either just individuals like yourself or for city officials and others with policymaking power?
I hope so. For me, one of the more important aspects of it, which is less visible when you're just there and using it, was that it implied a sense of trust. There is a sort of perceived power structure, whether it's the government or the corporations that own the buildings where you are. And when you are trusted, when we are trusted as a public by that perceived presence to treat something that's a vulnerable object, that's made of cotton rope that can easily be vandalized or stolen, when you're trusted to use and respect that, I think that it creates this feedback loop where you feel better about yourself and you feel better about your environment. You feel better about your culture at large. And it's sort of, I think, spreads goodwill. And because of that, I think people treated them very well. There was some concern when I had proposed the idea that they were going to quickly be destroyed because they weren't your conventional durable outdoor piece of furniture, let's say. But I think the public and the way they engaged with them and respected them and loved them sort of made a very strong case that we can trust ourselves more.
Daniel, what do you think about this idea of trusting the public to gather and trusting the public with an infrastructure for gathering?
I think the distrust is real. It's amazing how often I've heard something like what Jared just said about, you know, there's concern about this, there's reservations about this. There are some places that never come alive because somebody insisted that we had to have a cast concrete bench that's not movable and can't be stolen, as opposed to a comfortable piece of furniture that might move and actually might walk away at some point. There's a group called Project for Public Spaces that works a lot in different cities, and they're based in New York. And their sort of master stroke of thought there is Bryant Park. And one of the things they did was put foldable, movable chairs in Bryant Park. And the concern was, you know, somebody's going to walk off with them, somebody's going to bash someone else over the head with them. They do walk away, but not as often as you would think. But the fact that you got them there and you can move them around, and people can create little clusters of their own as opposed to really hard design spaces, it just creates a certain level of life and energy that wouldn't be there otherwise.
What about you? Where do you go to hang out in public in Kansas City? And what do you think it would take to get more people out enjoying public spaces? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Daniel Serta, hello again.
Hi.
And Jarrett Mellenbrecht, good morning to you.
Hello.
Daniel's an urban designer with Insight Planning, and Jarrett is an artist. We're talking about the need for public gathering spaces in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we want to hear about the places where you see people hanging out and the places you think have hangout potential, if only people would go there. 816-235-2888. We've heard the idea that it's sometimes activities that bring people together rather than infrastructure, but you would seem to still kind of need the infrastructure. I think of dog parks. All those people are there because they share an interest in playing outdoors with dogs, but if there wasn't a space set aside for that purpose, it wouldn't work. Same with skate parks. What about this sort of combination of infrastructure and special interests?
Well, the lack of spaces, especially planned and sort of dedicated spaces, makes it really hard, but it doesn't keep it from happening. I remember 10, 15 years ago downtown, there were constant complaints from specific property owners about skateboarders damaging landscaping, damaging rails and that sort of thing. People will find their places to do things. Again, they'll typically do it after hours, or they'll do it when, you know, it's not expressly verboten. You know, they'll make the place their own. And sometimes that's actually a way to initially get something going. We've had a lot of success in Kansas City, Kansas, developing trails for biking. We didn't have any at all. We didn't have any on-street bike lanes. We didn't have any trails. And we started them with some, what you might call almost sort of guerrilla, or what's sometimes called tactical urbanism, with some informal steps of, we're just going to go make a trail. Let's just go out there and do it. We're going to have an event. It's not going to be the best model physically. There are going to be some limitations to what you can do, but we're going to have, you know, 50 people here one day, and we're going to see what we can start.
And who's we, though? Who did this?
Well, the we, it's an interesting question, because it comes back to what you said before and what I was saying about it could start with a couple of people. It really started with a particular community leader, director of a local neighborhood association, who had the idea and wanted to support it. That organization has some staff. They were able to get some resources together, and they found a very, very dedicated initially volunteer who eventually became a staff member who took that project on for about 2.5 years as a paid employee. And all of a sudden, we have 4 miles of natural trails through woods that were places that kids were discouraged from going for decades.
You've mentioned that this is part of like a formal, there was a neighborhood organization, an association,
sure,
that people had joined, and that kind of got them in the loop and part of this group that was doing this. I wonder about the bowling alone aspect of this, I don't know, this need for public gathering spaces. Bowling alone, of course, being that study about how Americans don't join bowling leagues like they used to. They,
sure,
bowl alone, and that's the symptom of a larger trend away from membership in groups and participation in group activities.
Sure. Well, I think there's two things with the whole bowling alone thesis. One is the reality of it, that, you know, the formal associations they've changed. They've changed in complexion. They've changed in levels of membership and how active people are involved. But that being said, you know, it might be a little bit off the mark in the sense of, you know, we might not bowl together the way that we used to, but we might be doing something other than bowling that's sort of substituting for that and creating a different kind of opportunity. So it's a little bit of the interplay between the two. I mean, even within, I would describe it as, you know, leadership and initiative is a key aspect of this. If you could have any level of association, you could have any number of formally designed and dedicated spaces to do things. But if somebody doesn't pick up the mantle and take on the initiative to pull together an idea and start rallying volunteers initially and sometimes even, you know, pulling together resources to make an idea happen, it won't happen.
Jarrett, you kind of created a gathering space, not on your own. You applied for a grant and you were part of a project, but you just had an idea and you did something. Do you think that there are either advantages or drawbacks to, like, starting something that way?
I think it does require to be really successful kind of a combined effort. I think things can begin to evolve organically, but to sort of sustain themselves and become significant, I think it's helpful to have some sort of community leader or civic organization kind of perpetuating that and being sensitive to the nature of what it is that has evolved there without destroying it in the process. I remember when I was in high school, we used to hang out on the back steps of the Nelson Atkins Museum, and it was not something that was supported or sanctioned or anything like that, but it kind of happened. And I just like fast-forwarding to today and realizing that the lawn around the Nelson Atkins Museum, especially with the new block building, is a great place to go any time of day, and still at night is one of my favorite spots because of the way it's lit. And I think there is a case where there was a spot that was used, people came sort of organically, and the museum recognized what an asset the lawn was and very carefully and sensitively developed it to be something even, you know, more than I think what anybody thought it might turn out to be as far as usage goes.
Let's talk to Jana in Shawnee. Hi, Jana.
Oh, hi. It's actually Jana, but I won't hold that against you.
Thank you.
We have really found to be a treasure Black Hoof Park and Lake Lenexa down on Johnson County side of Kansas. I have three young children, and it's the perfect environment for us to have different play areas that are not only visible from pretty much any vantage point in that area, but different levels of play for the different ages of children that gather there. And we have lots of mom friends who have decided that is just a natural meeting place for us because there's really something for everyone. But I have to just say, this is a fantastic discussion, having been here for 15 years. We are going to own Kansas City. We're going to take ownership, and we're going to just get out there and explore and be trendsetters. And anyway, you guys have really given me lots to think about as I encourage my children to explore and be more childlike myself. I'll jump on the bed occasionally, if you will.
Well, thanks, Jana. I'm excited to hear about the places that you go exploring and transforming.
The way she mentioned play, I think, is really important for us to recognize the value of play and play at all ages. We talked about before how children don't need to be prompted to do that. Einstein said that, if I'm going to quote him, and I'll probably butcher it a little bit, but he said that play is the highest form of research. And I think that we can use our public spaces as a way to continue to support and encourage play through all ages.
Well, I think if you listen to what Jana was saying, you don't need someone to tell you you need to be there on Thursday at 10 o'clock in the morning, and that's the designated day that mothers can gather in that particular park. It does happen somewhat organically, but the flip side of what she said is there are activities, there's probably equipment there. I assume there's different levels of activities you can undertake given what's there in terms of the formally designed playground that the mothers and kids are formally gathering around.
Yeah, families' needs have been considered in how this is set up.
Exactly. And there are great examples of massive expenditures of money where there wasn't a lot of thought about the user experience, and you've got a playground that people are wondering, why doesn't anyone ever go there? They're just the opposite examples of where you have a lot of different types of activities facilitated through the provision of appropriate design. And then you've got an opportunity not only for the the kids to socialize with each other, but the parents who start seeing each other there on a regular basis.
Let's talk to Josh in Waldo. Hi, Josh.
Hello.
What can you share?
Well, I was just going to add that I'm an avid cyclist, and I really enjoy all of the trails and kind of dedicated bike spaces around Kansas City and how those things tend to lead to streams and rivers. Being a person from Missouri, being around the Missouri River is a huge thing for me, similar to the ocean and the fields that were talked about before, and Berkeley Riverfront Park is one of my favorite places. I do kind of wish there was a bus system that would go there and actually allow people to get there and get back out, but that was just my comment.
So thank you, Josh. That's both of his comments, both what he likes about gathering spaces and what he doesn't like about options to get to them is sort of transportation-centric. And that brings us back, Daniel, you started this conversation by saying that part of our challenge is that we are so auto-centric.
Sure. Well, it's not just that we're auto-centric. We have big chunks of infrastructure that often poses a really serious barrier to getting access to places like the riverfront or even one part of a neighborhood to another. But I think there's something really interesting in what he said. We've tussled for decades in Kansas City over the question of how can we orient ourselves more towards the riverfront? How can we redevelop our riverfronts? I think the most successful things that have happened to open up access and to get people near, whether it's a river or a stream in Kansas City, are the things that have happened more informally or at a smaller scale, where you have something like the trails that are created at Berkeley Riverfront Park, and then you have people discovering them. And now, you know, a lot of the presence of people that you see there are bicyclists like the person just called in, who are out there exploring and they're seeing it. And you've got a level of activity that wasn't there before. We've been having a very similar conversation in Wyandotte County because the Kansas River is largely inaccessible because it's behind a big levee, and the levee itself sits behind a lot of industry and railroad yards and that sort of thing. And again, it's one of those places, you know, you're not really supposed to be. Not only don't loiter, don't trespass. And we're opening up conversations now about opening entire segments of that. And you can't develop next to that river, but you could certainly create access to it, and it's starting to happen.
When I lived in New York, I was on the waterfront in Brooklyn, and the East River was very much at a time how the Missouri River is here now, where it was forbidding. You wouldn't want to go there. It was dirty. There was garbage. It was like a dangerous place to go to the edge of the river. And
I remember that.
Yeah. since their amazing new parks that have been pretty much covering every stretch of waterway around Manhattan and Brooklyn, since the park went in there in Brooklyn, they actually put a beach up to the water's edge, and kids go down and can play in the water, and the water in the river is clean, and there are jet skis. I mean, you would never imagine people driving jet skis on the East River in New York City, but with the right effort and the right team and the right design plan, you can open up this whole asset, I think, that we have here in Kansas City, which is being completely underutilized.
Do you think, I mean, that does bring up the question of what we can learn from cities that maybe do this a little bit better than we do. I don't know if there's just something about the way those cities are built that lends itself more, or if there is something that we can learn from looking at, say, New York or even other countries.
I think the reality is they've just gone and done it. We have, every city's unique. Every city has its own assets and its own challenges. We have, pieces of our landscape, both the built environment, the natural environment in Kansas City, that people are constantly rediscovering. And it's that process of rediscovery. And again, it usually starts with one or two people that have led to really amazing initiatives. I think about Darby Trotter and the work that he's done with the Riverfront Heritage Trail. I mean, Darby's been shepherding that through. There are a lot of people that have contributed to that. But that started literally just as an idea of, can we at least have maybe biking and walking access near the waterfronts? And it's become a large interconnected network. That being said, there are a lot of gaps. There are a lot of places that doesn't connect. There are a lot of challenges in getting to the next segment and pulling it together another piece. But again, it starts with that individual initiative and that sort of entrepreneurial streak of, why can't we just do this?
What does a city gain by just doing it?
I think it really starts to leverage things that, again, are often under our nose and that we didn't imagine could really transform the way that we live and the opportunities that we have to interact with each other all the time.
That's all the time we have for today's Central Standard. Daniel Serta of Insight Planning, thank you for being our city design guru.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And Jarrett Mellenbrech, thanks for telling your story. Viva Los Hammocks.
Thank you, Gina.
Earlier in the show, we spoke with North Kansas City Councilman Zachary Clevenger about a food truck hub in Mackin Park. You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll have a portrait session with a woman who is a force at the public library. From a childhood in Kenya to a passion for closing the digital divide in Kansas City, that's tomorrow. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with special thanks to Matt Hodapp for today's show. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's a wrap. Stick around for Up to Date next.